The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I'm Jacqueline McKenzie. I'm a solicitor. I specialise in various areas to do with human rights, so immigration, asylum, refugee law. I also run a think tank called the Organisation for Migration Advice and Research, which at the moment really does just do pro bono work for people who can't afford lawyers. But we also want to look at researching some of the major issues of the day where immigration is concerned. What made me choose to specialise in immigration and asylum is a very interesting question, because a lot of people said to me, don't do it, don't touch it. All black lawyers do immigration and asylum. You know, it's almost like it's the ghetto area. But I was working at a firm, well, I trained at a firm called Bernberg Pierce Solicitors, which is sort of, you know, big human rights firm. And you have to do what's called training seats. And I went into the immigration seats quite despondent, thinking, oh gosh, it's all going to be about people wanting visas to come into the UK. And on the very first day, I dealt with a case involving a woman who had been a refugee from the Rwandan war. This woman had been in a refugee camp and had been raped and contracted HIV, but also got pregnant and had the baby. And it was all verified by the Red Cross. You know, it was a particular program to bring them to the UK. And, you know, I mean, I just cried. I just sat there crying. And then I saw everybody looking at me as if, you don't do that, you don't, you know. And so I sort of realised and left the room. And then when I gathered my composure, I went back in. And I'd already done a master's degree in international relations. So I'm fascinated by what's going on around the world, issues around conflict, humanitarian issues. I had that as an academic interest. And it just, I just thought, my God, I hadn't realised immigration law would bring me back into that world, you know? Because in order to do her case, you had to know a little bit about what had gone on in Rwanda, where the refugees had been taken to. She'd gone to Kenya. Their journey to the UK, all the ramifications, all that. And it was just so fascinating. And I thought, this is what I want to do, because it's much, much more than just, you know, helping a student stay in the UK and that sort of thing. It's about really safeguarding lives.
What is the Windrush scandal for people who may not know, or people who know but are kind of confused about it, I guess?
Yes. The Windrush scandal is a little bit confusing because everybody associates it with that boat that arrived in Tilbury Docks in 1948.
The Empire Windrush brings to Britain 500 Jamaicans.
That boat brought quite a large number of people from the Caribbean, but not just the Caribbean. There were people on board from Europe and other countries too. But it's seen as a symbolic start of the mass migration of people from the Caribbean. I think the majority of people on board were Jamaicans. However, we know, you know, there were people, you know, in Roman times, you know, there were Africans here, and during the slave trade, you know, people who were held in captive were brought here. So it's not really, you know, a lot of people say it was when we all started arriving. It's nothing to do with that whatsoever. It's the start, I suppose, of the mass migration from the English-speaking Commonwealth. And what happened, those people in their own countries were actually born under the British flag, so to speak. You know, they were born as British citizens or British subjects. And so when they came here, that's what they came here as. You know, for them, in their minds, coming from Jamaica or Barbados or Grenada or anywhere to the UK was the same as, you know, some white person in Liverpool travelling to London. You were just moving from one bit of the terrain to the other bit. But what they were given were these passports, which were actually inferior. So they weren't quite British citizens, but they were subjects, and they were conferred with the right of abode and all manner of different things. So they were here, and most people were fine because, you know, people weren't checking on things. But in 1971, as a result of a lot of racist speeches by people like Enoch Powell, you've probably heard of the Rivers of Blood speech, people were getting concerned that too many people were coming And so the British Nationality Act was created, and it was enacted on the 1st of January 1973, which effectively withdrew British citizenship from people who thought they already had it. Mm. But people who were in the country were given an opportunity to register for it. But a lot of people didn't bother to do that, and a lot of people didn't understand what it meant. They thought, well, I'm British, I haven't got to do anything. In the 1980s, there was another initiative for people to register. And again, a lot of people that by I actually worked on that initiative, and a lot of people that bypassed them, they thought, you know, for all manner of reasons, and people ill, mental health, some in prison, you know, all I've seen all manner of reasons why people did not avail themselves of that opportunity. But and generally speaking, they were able to survive in the society without too much formal documentation. Nobody was bothering them. Most of them had Cockney accents or Brummie accents or Mancurian accents. Nobody thought this is somebody who's just arrived. Mm. But 2012, around there, and particularly 2014, we had what's now coined the hostile environment. We had particular legislation in 2014. But there was also previous legislation which literally turned everybody into an immigration officer. The state, you know, schools, universities, landlords, airlines were checking that you had the right to board a flight because you had the right document. And lots of people that had worn out in their passport, mm. stamps that had gone very thin. And so that's how we saw people being left behind. But very briefly, it simply is, because of the hostile environment, a number of people were being asked to produce documents that they didn't have. And so they were losing their jobs or losing housing or losing the opportunity to get medical treatment, university education or higher education opportunities, all sorts of things was happening. And it was because they didn't realise that they'd been stripped of their British citizenship status, hadn't availed themselves of an opportunity to register as Britain, mm-hmm. as British, or had not had the money to naturalise, because that was the next thing that you had to do after the 80s. You had to actually spend money, thousands of pounds as it is today, to naturalise as a British citizen, so people couldn't do that. Mm. And so you've got this group of people who just literally fell by the wayside, so to speak, and it wasn't until they started experiencing real problems with access to services that people thought, well, hold on a minute, these people have been here since the 50s, 60s and 70s. What are you talking about? They don't have the right to be here. Yeah. And that is, in effect, the Windrush scandal. People who had the right to be here, either because they were British or because they were settled, being told that they don't have the right to be here because they didn't have the right piece of paper. Some of them were detained. Some were deported and some have died.
When was your first contact with somebody who was a victim of this?
For me, it was 2015 when I was running a training program for ambassadors and high commissioners from the Caribbean countries. They have a CARICOM caucus of high commissioners. And I was training them on immigration law and how to deal with the Home Office on certain things, mm. how to prepare people coming for holidays, you know, what sorts of documents they need to bring with them, what they need to say when they meet with the immigration officer at the airport, because they don't need visas. Mm. So they just turn up and then they get all manner of problems when they arrive and some of them end up in detention. So that's what the training was about. And that was on the agenda in 2015. Mm. You know, can you, as diplomats, lobby the British government to sort of give some sort of status to this older generation without them having to pay for it? So that, to me, in my consciousness, is my sort of start of realising that there is a major injustice here. And then, of course, we had the escalation of it as a scandal or it becoming a scandal as a result of the work being done by the media, particularly the Guardian newspaper, mm. With that whole series of articles, which I don't necessarily like that approach of, you know, just literally spilling out everyone's beans just to get headlines and just to get clicks. But it brought it into the national consciousness. Mm.
Do you feel like the attention it was given helped or hindered there?
No, I think it helped. Mm-hmm. It helped. I particularly have concerns about how, I suppose, from an ethnographic perspective, how our stories are told and who they're told by. And I certainly don't say that, you know, white journalists don't have a right to tell our story. I mean, they broke it. They brought it to fruition and people got a lot of help as a result of them. But they don't necessarily always understand the nuances, I think, of our culture and how people are. And so some of our people are very suggestible. And I think some of them have been abused a little bit mm. in the media, you know, just to make the story more interesting and yeah. more exciting. And that's a problem across the board. You know, black journalists do the same thing. Mm. So I've had some quiet criticism, but not major criticism, because these journalists broke this story. And if it weren't for them, I don't think the story would have gained the momentum it did. Mm-hmm. I don't think the nation would have been as appalled as they were, because it was that, you know, the reaction of the nation, including, you know, white people out in the shires and, you know, Daily Mail readers. There was hardly any dissent on saying, well, these people shouldn't be here anyway. You know, people were just shocked. And I suppose it's because you have this thing about good migrant, bad migrant. You know, people saw little old ladies from the Caribbean who are deemed harmless. So that's problematic too, because they have no more rights to me than a young man who's been here all his life and has probably got involved in a little bit of drug dealing and is facing deportation. Mm. I don't think one group's better than the other, but the newspapers and the media generally profiled, you know, nice people as opposed to not so nice people. So there was a lot of sympathy for them, but it did get the government to move into gear and set up the Windrush Task Force scheme, which enabled people to get documentation. Some of them just got a card saying that they're settled. Others have got British citizenship, and now people are trawling through the process of trying to claim compensation.
How reactive have the government been in dealing with these cases? Because a lot of the time, the current government, they say things, but what they say doesn't really match what they do in practice.
Yeah. I think the government was very quick to set up the task force. Mm-hmm. I think, and in the early days, people were going up to the Home Office in Croydon and Liverpool and coming out with their biometric cards, and it was working smoothly. And I think the Home Office tell us just under 10,000, it's 9,000 something people have gone through and been processed. And so that's good, although we understand it should be about 60,000 people. And so we don't know if people are not coming forward or if the Home Office is sitting on applications. We don't know what the problem is. But it's still problematic. You know, people are having to give their biometric data, which I think is wrong, given, you know, the status that they came into the country with. There's been terrible delays in some cases, although, you know, the Home Office is saying, well, we've got joined up government, so we can go to the NHS, we can go to HMRC, get your national insurance records or your tax records to prove who you are, how long you've been here. Because remember, part of the problem is that a lot of the schools that people went to no longer exist, and, you know, the jobs they had, you know, those places have closed down. So proving how long you've been in the UK with no documents going back over the 50s, 60s and 70s has been nigh on impossible in some cases. So the government is saying to people, well, we can try and we can... And it hasn't. That's not been the case at all. Mm. I mean, I sit with people and I have to write off to HMRC for their national insurance records. I'm spending my time looking up Google to see if I could find a school. You know, we're writing to doctors. You used to have to pay for the medical records when the scandal first broke, but now doctors are giving those to you free, thankfully. Mm. But it's a nightmare. It's and the people who are caught up in the scandal are actually very vulnerable. Vulnerable by age, but also there are all sorts of issues around health and education and poverty and disaffection. And so the least able group to deal with this, and they're having to. So it's very traumatic. And so we're still having lots of problems. And then we've got the compensation scheme, which, although the actual form itself is something that you can navigate quite easily, that is not the job. The job is to substantiate a claim with evidence and try and maximise your claim and think through what your losses really are. And put the evidence together. And people are really struggling with that. And just recently, although I think there's some new figures today, but I haven't had a chance to see them yet, but the last set of figures that came out just a couple of weeks ago, you know, only £63,000 had been paid to 32 people. And we know somebody who's been offered £22,000 out of that. So does it mean all the rest of the people have shared? I mean, that is not adequate redress. So, so it's very, very problematic. And one of the big problems is that no resources at all has come in to the communities, any of the communities, the Asian, African, Caribbean communities, to help their own people to deal with these issues. Whereas with the Europeans, we don't want to be divisive. And I think how they're being treated under this EU settled status scheme is also an abomination. But at least they're getting support. There's adverts everywhere. There's surgeries all over the place. We are having to do surgeries ourselves and do them pro bono. They've got funded surgeries. £9 million was given to 50 organisations to work with 200,000 vulnerable EU citizens to help them get settled status. Now, I do settle status claims and they take me about 30 minutes. On the Windrush cases, it takes me days to do each one. And I have to see each person several times. And because these are ancient and historic issues, trying to get and piece together people's histories going back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even the 80s, is so difficult. Mm. And yet we've been treated with contempt because no resources has come in for us to do this work properly. And it's just thankful that we've got some good people who are agreeing to do this on a voluntary basis. But we're now all over capacity and it's reached a crisis.
In terms of getting the documents, that was the case. You was working on Dexter Bristol's case.
Yes, yes.
And you couldn't find his school records because his primary school and his two secondary schools had been closed down.
That's correct.
And there was there was no way for you to find it.
That's right.
And then by the time you actually found the evidence, he had sadly passed away.
Absolutely. And his case is an interesting one because a lot of people always say, oh, you know, these Windrushers, they must have all been stupid people. You know, why didn't they sort themselves out? Now, he had tried to sort himself out. That's what he told us. He said he'd made contact with the Home Office. The Home Office actually denied it, but he's dead, so they can say anything, can't they? But that was before I was involved. But when we got involved, he had, you know, there's a lot of people who come from Africa, Caribbean, Asia, who have one name on their birth certificate, their dad's name or their mum's name, and there's all sorts of problems with that.
Yeah.
And that was him. So we first of all had to get an amendment to his birth paper. I happened to do some work in Grenada, so I was in Grenada, and I went to the registrar. We then had to get him a new Grenadian passport because you cannot submit an application to... you can't submit an application to the Home Office without a passport. So we had to do all of that. So that delayed it. And in the meantime, we were just writing off to every, you know, we were trying all sorts of things. And it was when his mother mentioned that he'd been in some sort of, I think, some approved school, as they were in those days. The penny clicked. We thought, let's try social services. And social services came up with some evidence that put him here in 1974. And although we needed him here in 1973, I had done a case based on 74 and it had worked. So I thought, well, let's just try it. And we wrote to him on the... So it was Good Friday. We wrote to him on the Thursday. We posted that letter to him on the Thursday before Good Friday to tell him, I think we're going to be okay. And he died the Saturday and the letter was found unopened. And because the Friday was the Good Friday, so it was a public holiday. He died the Saturday, so he never got the letter. Mm-hmm. And his mum, luckily we copied it to his mum, so, you know, there was absolute verification that, you know, we had sent the letter out. And his mum got hers, but and also his was found anyway by the police unopened. So real, real tragedy. And then we had that dreadful inquest, which, you know, the coroner's system is part of the state. And although there was much evidence from cardiologists and from our evidence that, you know, what he was experiencing as a result of his status could have been a contributory factor, I suppose because it's not definitive, if you die of a heart attack, you could have died of, you know, the coroner just wasn't prepared to go that far, didn't even mention it in her findings that, you know, he was under stress. So it's an appalling judgment. In fact, I want to write a play about it because I actually think it's so appalling. The evidence was so clear for her to at least have mentioned it as a factor in the narrative, even if it wasn't the cause of death, because the cause of death was a heart attack, but she wouldn't go that far. And so the family haven't really had justice at all.
Yeah, no, and you and his mum both testified that it was... You could see the effects that this process was having.
I saw it. He was coming into our office and he was just getting more and more depressed, which is why I wrote the letter to him. And I thought it would cheer him up. I thought he'll get that over the Easter and it will cheer him up.
Because
he was also downtrodden and downbeat and this isn't never going to work. And he was facing losing his benefits and his housing because he was reliant on those things. He couldn't get a job. He'd been offered a job and they wouldn't let him work because he didn't have proof of his status in the country.
Yeah, a lot of the time, because it's just given this the name of a scandal, we forget that it's real people's lives that
are... That's such a good point. That's such a good point. Maybe we shouldn't even be using the word scandal because it's much worse than that. It's actually much worse than that.
Because, and especially with, in terms of, like, governments, like, they're... It's not a regular job. You can make a mistake at your regular job and just, like, whatever, we clean it up.
Yes.
These when people are making mistakes, it's people's lives that they're playing with on a mass level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think some of them are guilty of criminal acts, I think.
Absolutely, they are. So...
Certainly negligent acts, anyway.
With that being said, now there's a concern about deportations to Jamaica.
Yes.
What is the difference between the current deportations going on and the Windrush scandal?
Well, I mean, they're linked indirectly and directly, but they are also very different. Mm-hmm. You know, deportations happen when someone's been convicted of a crime and sentenced to more than 12 months. You know, it's automatic mm-hmm. at that point, although you get a right of appeal and you can appeal on the basis of your family life and other human rights features. And a lot of people do, and they do that successfully. But for me, though, and a country has a right. It has a right to protect its borders and deport people. I wouldn't say it doesn't. Mm. But what we are seeing, particularly with these charters and in individual cases, because people are deported all the time on scheduled flights. So you're going off on your holiday. It could be somebody at the back of the plane who's being deported. It's happening almost daily to all countries. But the charters bring it into our consciousness because they're so awful. It's like chattel slavery, really, isn't it? Chain ganging people and frog marching them onto a plane. But the connection to Windrush to me is that a lot of the people who are on those charters or people who are up on scheduled flights are actually the descendants of Windrushers. And I wonder at what point do we decide where does Windrush start and where does it end in terms of a definition? You know, the Home Office has got this arbitrary date. Well, if you're here before 1988, you can benefit. Mm-hmm. But there's a campaign to widen the definition of that. You know, if your grandparents were here and your parents were here and you happened to come when you were 19 instead of 18, so if you came as a child, you can benefit, but you just came on the wrong side of the birth date. Mm-hmm. You can't benefit from it. We've also got a lot of discrimination in nationality law. So there's a whole number of people who couldn't take British citizenship if their father was British but wasn't married to the mother. Mm. There's still some discrimination with people who are born overseas, the British Overseas Territories like Anguilla and Montserrat and British Virgin Island. Those people, there's still that discrimination there. It's been sorted out in the UK. But a lot of people aren't aware of that. It's also extremely expensive to sort your immigration status out. It costs thousands and thousands of pounds. Mm. So what you find is that people just could not avail themselves of it. I mean, there are three cases I know of where people were in care. When you get their care records, you see in the care records from social services a lot of discussion about, oh, we must sort out this person's immigration status. And it didn't happen. So they failed, these young people. They could have been British citizens. Oh, this whole thing about the state failing people, the whole thing being prohibitively expensive, the issue around what defines somebody as being, you know, having the right to be here, one in terms of the Windrush legacy and the bloodline and future generations, but also in terms of culture and identity. Because the fact that you don't have a British certificate that says you're British or a passport doesn't signify anything. Mm. You know, most of the American population don't have a passport, but they're American. So These things should not be signifiers. If you've been in this country for most of your life, you came here at a very young age, or I would say even up to the age of 18, and you've committed a crime, you're part of this society, you've learned you're offending here. There are indicators here that have caused you to choose, you know, and when I say choose, because it's not always a conscious choice, it's poverty. It's racism. You know, people go for jobs, they can't get it. They want to live, they want to enjoy what everybody else is enjoying. They take a chance. There's trafficking, there's the grooming, there's the county lines. Yeah. All these things are factors. You can't just simply say, well, people have committed crime and that's the end of the story. You've got to look at it as a whole. And then there's also this really big issue that, okay, you know, British people commit crime and they're not, you know, they go to prison and that's the end of it. But, you know, people who are de facto British, they may not have the paperwork, they commit a crime and then you're going to subject them to a second bout of punishment. And people think that's okay. So I've got a family of three brothers who were all convicted of the same crime and it was a terrible crime. It was GBH. They beat up a bouncer very badly, although they say that the bouncer was racist towards them first. But yes, they were deemed to have acted over the top in their reaction to the racism because the racism was verbal. Mm-hmm. And so they all got 4 years. But one was born before the parents was married and the other two weren't. So the other two didn't face deportation. And the one who did was deported. His parents are here. His grandmother is here, who's Windrush. Parents are Windrush. He's got a house here. He had had time. He was working as a water engineer. He'd bought a house here. Mm. His partner's here. And he's languishing in Grenada in a part of the country where there's no jobs, nothing. And he's actually just going out of his mind. And those are the sort of stories, you're absolutely right. The word scandal and hostile environment, almost start making the thing kind of cuddly in a way. Really, as though European people don't really go beneath the surface of those meaningless phrases to have a look at how this is really impacting on people's lives and destroying people's lives. And it's not just destroying the life of the person who's been deported, but also the lives of the people here who are British citizens. His mother cries all the time. His little sister, who's under Great Ormond Street Hospital because she's not well, she doesn't understand what's gone on and she's always crying for her brother. I mean, it's far-reaching.
As the kind of bar for who is and who isn't British kind of gets raised, do you think we, in general, as black people, should be worried about where we stand in this country?
Well, we should be worried about where we stand in this country for a number of reasons, because one, we're seeing racism on the rise and we're seeing irresponsible government, that there's almost no regard for issues around racism. You know, it's almost like anything goes. We saw with Brexit and with the December general elections that both racism and migration reared their heads in a very, very ugly way. There's a sort of backlash. Just this morning, I'm driving over to court. I was listening to a radio programme, and the discussion was, are there too many black and ethnic minority people on TV? That was the discussion. And people were actually ringing up as a proportion, and also LGBT, as a proportion to their presence in the society. That was actually, some journalist, some producer somewhere thought that that was a programme worthy of being made. And people were calling in, with both sides of the spectrum, people were calling in to say that it was an issue. So we are in a, we're in a really precarious times. But in terms of specifically about where we sit within the immigration paradigm, more dangerous. One, because we're seeing, you know, the government playing to the gallery, wanting to show it's tough on migrants, because it goes down well with a large section of the country and its constituents. So you've got that. And in order to do that, they will start deporting people who, like Trevon, Rashawn Davis, who shouldn't be deported because he's been out of prison for almost a decade and he only served 2 months
and joint enterprise.
For joint enterprise. It was a robbery off a two mobile phones, and he wasn't the person who took them. You just would not have seen cases like that many years ago. But the one thing that a lot of people in the, particularly the African and Caribbean community, who, when you try to talk to them about it, they say, well, that doesn't really concern us. And that's the Shamima Begum case. And I tell you, it very much concerns us.
Because she was stripped.
She was stripped of her British citizenship.
She was born in this country.
She was born in this country. But the arguments are that she can avail herself of the citizenship of one of her parents. Now, my parents are Jamaican and Grenadian. I was born here. I didn't grow up here for all of my time. I didn't go to secondary, so I had very little secondary education here first year, and then I went to secondary. I did O-levels and A-levels in Grenada. However, technically, if I was to commit a crime, I could have my British citizenship stripped, because I could be told, well, you could be Grenadian or you could be Jamaican, which effectively we could be. We're entitled to those citizenships by virtue of those constitutions. So technically, everybody's at risk, because when the whole idea about stripping citizenship came about, it was about terrorism. And people thought, well, fair game, you know, because these are really heinous people. And then it was about the paedophiles, you know, these Asian men in Rochdale and Yorkshire and places. And people thought, well, you know. And now it's Shamima Begum, and people are still saying it's awful, because they're saying, well, she's ISIS bride and she's a terrorist. But nobody's got any evidence that she's a terrorist. I mean, you know, the only evidence we do have is that at the age of 14, I know she went when she was 15, but at the age of 14, she was groomed online by somebody. She's a child. But we do not know what her life was like in, you know, in Syria. We know she lost lots of children, and she knew about three of them. She could have had the most horrendous life. She could have just been subjugated to serving, you know, those ISIS fighters and her husband and, you know, sort of domestic work. I mean, you know, nobody has any evidence. Well, the British government might have, but they've not shared it with us. Nobody's got any evidence that she herself is a terrorist. But everybody puts her in that frame. And so people think it's legitimate. And a lot of our people think it's legitimate because, you know, they don't think terrorism. Think, oh, well, it's them. It's Muslims or it's Asians. It isn't our issue. But it is very much our issue, because what it's got is mission creep. That you start with one thing, terrorism, mm-hmm. paedophiles. Where does it go tomorrow?
Yeah.
Could be a drug dealers tomorrow. And it could be, and drug dealers are in every single community. I'm not saying they're in the black community mm-hmm. alone. But we are seeing in terms of the deportation paradigm, you know, the government will say it's murderers and rapists yeah. and all that. And it might be one murderer and one rapist. But the vast majority are people caught up in drug dealing. And the drug dealing, I think, has to be discussed within the context of the position that black people occupy in the society and why people might end up in that field.
And what do you think we non-lawyers in the black communities can do to help in this situation?
Well, I think it's just really because there's a lot of ignorance in the community, and you do hear, you know, particularly the older section of it, you do hear, I've heard older relatives say, let them go back, you know, they come in, embarrass us. And it's just really having those discussions, because when you have the discussions, people, especially when you illustrate those discussions with some of the cases, people do think, they stop and think, you know, because there's a lot of ignorance and people just think, oh, yeah, well, they've, you know, let them go. I think, though, that what we need to do, we also need to build movements around it. And not everybody's going to be interested in that or have the time for that. But we do need to build movements. I mean, we don't have anything here. We don't have... I know there's supposed to be a Black Lives Matter in the UK, but I don't hear of them all. I've not heard them comment on this issue at all.
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard anything about it. And we've got no prominent leaders. I mean, we've got a few MPs who do some good work and make some good soundings, but it's very temporal. Yeah. So when something's, you know, sort of, you know, hot...
Some who were completely the opposite a few years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Their voting patterns. Yeah, there's real problems. There's real problems in terms of our representation. Mm-hmm. There's real problems in terms of our voice. We've got no real resources. There's individuals in the community who've done well, but there's no pooled resources. So if you're the Jewish community, you know you've got the Board of Jewish Deputies. Or if you're the Asian community or the Muslim community, rather, you know you've got the... Muslim Council of Great Britain. People have got organisations that are powerful. They can ring up number 10 and say, what on earth are you doing here? Sort this out. We don't have anything like that at all. And so one of the things, and I see some amazing, like yourself, I see young people. I was saying this the other day, and, you know, young people, despite what's going on with knife crime and drug deals, it's tiny. That's a tiny proportion. But I just see so many amazing... Where I do the pro bono Windrush surgeries at the Black Cultural Archives, they have this open mic session. So when I'm finishing, I stand by the door and listen to all these young people, and the poetry, the word rhythms are so deep. And you just think... And it's about contemporary issues like deportation or like racism or LGBT or anything. And I just think to myself, wow, you know, how do we galvanise that? And I don't know, because I can't say to people, oh, come give us your time and let's form a movement. You know, that's, you people have to evolve into that. But we really do need that. We need more media. And so it's great to see what you're doing. We definitely need more media, different forms of it, different forms of media. And we also need to start building our economic base, because without the economic base, we can't respond to things adequately. You can't put out a newsletter. You can't put out, you know, you want to put out all these older Caribbean people who sit in churches, you know, every Sunday, you know, we'd like to leaflet them or send them stuff and say, this is what's going on. Yeah. There's no resources to do it. So we've really got to build our base. We really are still, you know, the Windrush generation, I think it was last year or year before, you know, there was a 70th anniversary and everybody, oh, so it would have been 2018, would have been the 70th anniversary of the Windrush boat. And everybody was getting excited and saying, we must celebrate. And I was saying, we should probably be crying. Because if we've been here for 70 years, what have we achieved? What have we got to show for it? And I think that's the challenge now, really, is to start building ourselves up to be taken seriously. Because I don't necessarily think that it was a conspiracy and that the government thought, oh, we can get out maybe 1,000 little old black people and that's going to put a dent in the net migration figures, so we're going to look good. It was a major cock-up because they're incompetent, and the Home Office is an extremely incompetent organisation, and other bits of government are too. But what they did know is that the resistance to... Once the scandal broke, and they were under pressure because I said the prime ministers were here, but once they left, they knew the resistance would be muted because there aren't enough of us and we're not unified and there's no resources and we don't have a lobby, we don't have a voice. We don't even have a unified narrative. So they knew that, and they just... And that's why, to this day, they're still treating the people affected by the scandal with contempt.
Thank you.
Transmission roundup.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.